Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with your host Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Open Minds Radio. This is Alejandro Rojas, and this is our last Thursday show in the studio, and luckily enough, we're able to go out with a bang and have a studio guest. We've got Michael Schratt here, a military aerospace historian. We got lucky that he was coming into town on a Thursday, so we're able to have him on the show. And on the last show that we're doing solely over the internet, because starting tomorrow will be our first show over the airwaves, AM 1100 KFNX will be in studio, in their studio broadcasting. We'll still have the live video, so no worries there, mates, just like we have now. So if you go to openminds.tv and go to the radio tab, you'll be able to see us live on the video, or you can listen to us, of course, on Blog Talk Radio, where we are now. And don't worry for you podcasters, because we have a lot of podcasters out there. What we're going to do is we're going to have the show live on Fridays at noon Arizona time. You could either listen from the KFNX website or, of course, tuning in at AM 1100 if you're in the Phoenix metro area. And I guess it reaches all the way to Tucson and Sedona, so we're all over the place in this area. You can also watch us live on the website, or if you're a podcaster, we will rebroadcast the Friday shows the following Thursday. So at this time, actually, if you're a blog talker, you're still going to be able to listen to the show. You'll just be listening to a show that is 6 days old, and then you can tune in the next day. So you'll be able to listen to the show live, hear it again on Thursday, because there's a lot of information for your notes and everything. And then you'll be able to tune in on Friday, so because people can't get enough of the show. And I can't blame them, especially when we have great guests like today. So I'm really excited about the guests. We're going to talk about Nazi technology, possible flying discs that they've created, you know, way back and starting possibly in the 20s, but what they might have had after World War II that the Americans got their hands on. We'll be talking about the triangles. We'll be talking about how, because Michael Schratt here, being an aerospace historian, he's looked at a lot of black projects and has a lot of information on some of the cutting-edge technologies or the possible technologies that we may have. And, of course, these things are extremely advanced, so no doubt, possibly a lot of what we're mistaking for extraterrestrial craft or actual terrestrial craft. But we'll talk about his thoughts on the ET issue. But first, let's get into the news. Not a whole lot of big news outside of sightings, some neat sightings out there. But we'll start with an interesting story that came out the first day of the year, and that was on some California psychics. And they had predicted that Larry King will interview an extraterrestrial in 2010. So that would be a great interview, and I'm sure that will get him a lot of viewers. He'll break some records on that one if that indeed happens. That'd be very interesting. I guess Sylvia Brown is her name, another famous psychic. She said on Montel's show or something like that that she thought extraterrestrials would reveal themselves and create some diplomatic relations with us Earth humans during 2010 too. So it could be an exciting year for us in the ufology field. We'll see. Other than that, a lot of sightings all over the place. A few in the UK. The UK's always got a lot going on. Interesting story in the Ithaca Journal where this was a guy, a writer, who actually was friends with Hector Quintanilla's son. Hector Quintanilla being one of the guys who ran Project Blue Book for the Air Force for a while. So that was an interesting story. One of the better sighting reports out there is, of course, posted on the MUFON site. And at the MUFON, well, one of the people who works for MUFON, Roger Marsh, who's actually, I think, the director of communications for MUFON, he is the UFO examiner. So if you go to this site, examiner.com, they have some local examiners or national examiners, and Roger Marsh is the national UFO examiner, a very popular article, and he posts a lot of the reports that are showing up on the MUFON site. And he posted a video that MUFON received of a UFO over California. So the witness said he watched it for 5 minutes before it disappeared, so you can go look at that video and see what you think. And then after listening to today's show, you may realize that, hey, that is actually a tachyon-emitting engine, and we have that technology. Yeah, we're going to talk about tachyons. This isn't just Star Trek, people. So also, this is one of the real funny stories. I haven't posted this story yet, but I'm going to right after the show is done. This is an ad by a gym that is creating a lot of controversy. And I think we're going to put that up if you're watching live. You'll probably be able to see it on the video. Really funny. It says, warning to Earthlings that when the aliens come, they're going to eat the fatties first. So they're telling people, get to the gym, shaping up, so you're not the first to get eaten by the aliens. Now, we don't have evidence that aliens actually eat people, so I really don't think you have to worry about that, but I really should get to the gym because I'm a little bigger than I should be. Look, there's me, and I kind of look like maybe a fatty there. I got to get to the gym just in case, so I'm not one of the first eaten. I'm a vegetarian, too, so I would have some clean meat to eat, so that could even further put me in danger. There. So there's the news, not a whole lot of news in the UFO headlines out there. But remember, you can go to the website, openminds.tv, and we post headlines practically every day because usually there's a lot going on. We didn't post any yesterday because there weren't a whole lot. But I have a host of URLs that I'm going to post after the show. The reason I was busy is because I was just writing a story, actually. And that I did post today, and that's called Scientists and UFOs. They are interested because there are a lot of scientists who have researched UFOs. Some of you who are into the subject may have had friends, and I get this all the time, that if there is really something to the subject, well, then scientists would be interested. Well, they are interested, my friend, and I have dozens and dozens of scientists listed on this story and how they were involved and how they started most of the major research organizations in this field, including one of them that you have been looking into, Michael, which is CUFOS.
That's correct. Center for UFO Studies, that's 2457 West Peterson Avenue.
And I wrote a lot about that one because who started that one?
Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
J. Allen Hynek, and I have him in on the front page of the story here, on his cameo appearance on Close Encounters, which is the Steven Spielberg movie, because he came up with the Close Encounter, the term.
That's correct.
Well, let's get into you and your background. How You're an aerospace historian. What does that all entail?
Well, first of all, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be a part of your program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I really enjoy tracking down the unorthodox aircraft that have been bought and paid for by the American taxpayer, but which are exempt from congressional oversight. That's sort of my forte. And what I've really made a focus to do and really put a lot of effort into tracking down the military hardware, the nuts and bolts evidence, that, so that we can stitch this story together with some type of a historical legacy.
Exempt from congressional oversight, does that technically make them illegal?
Well, if you look at the Research, Development, Test, and Evaluations Program, R1, that is the budgetary report that's handed out to Congress every January 27th, and you can go get a copy of this document from the Library of Congress, which is just in back of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. In this rather boring 12-page document, they list by line item the different programs that the DOD is supporting, like C-17 operations, F-16 operations, electronic countermeasures, and it tells you what the project is, and it tells you how much procurement funding was allocated for that particular program element number. Mm-hmm. However, when you further go down through this boring 24-page document, you'll find that some of these programs, all there is a code name designation. There's nothing to indicate how much was spent on the program or what the program entails. And so those are the black budget programs.
Okay.
So the concept here is you take the total amount from the knowns. What's left over are the unknowns or the black programs.
Mm-hmm. What are those budgets estimated to be?
Well, as of now, it's estimated to be well over $400 billion per year.
Mm-hmm.
$400 billion per year. Very few people in Congress have any need to know on these programs. And so my endeavor, my mandate, is to release some of these programs, if possible, within the public domain, take that technology, trickle it down to the civilian sector, and then make that propulsion systems available to people around the world so that we can start reversing the effects of the damage that we've done to this environment.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And it would seem, I mean, the most advanced technology that we've been made aware of, I don't know if it would be the stealth fighters or is the Joint Strike Fighter even higher and more advanced stealth than the stealth?
Sure. If you go to Oshkosh at the end of every July, this has been going on for decades now, it's called Air Venture, which is the largest air show in the world, and they do exhibit some of the cutting-edge fighters. We've seen the B-2, we've seen the SR-71, we've seen the B-1 bomber, the U-2 has shown up there, and so we're supposed to believe that the U.S. Air Force is showing us what we've bought and paid for with our tax dollars. That's the whole purpose of, you know, many of these air shows, and we're supposed to really believe that this is the best we can do. But if you really look into the reference works and the historical literature within the aerospace industry, you can see this gigantic diversion, one being a dog and pony show that you see at your local air show, and then a different set of vehicles, nuts and bolts hardware that is completely independent from what we know, and that is the black world that we'll certainly get into detail today.
Mm-hmm. So the technology, I mean, getting back to that kind of the Joint Strike Fighters and the stealth technology, that's decades old, right?
That's obsolete technology. It's already, when the F-117A came out, November the 10th, 1988, it was already obsolete. That's when they released it within the public domain. The Northrop B-2 stealth bomber, that's November 22nd, 1988, that was even obsolete because we know that stealth programs started under Project Harvey from the DARPA, that's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency under the Carter administration via 1977. So between 1977 and 1988, that was a black classified unacknowledged special access program. But when that plane was released, it's already completely obsolete. They have third, fourth, fifth generation stealth technology aircraft that are levels of magnitude lower radar cross-section.
we're back. Okay. Sorry about that. And we're back. All right. Luckily, we had another board, but our board went out. So some sort of electromagnetic issue there. But we were talking about, the technology that I'm sure they must have now, which is, because you said all those others are way obsolete.
Yeah, we're talking about aircraft that are orders of magnitude much more classified than the Northrop B-2 stealth bomber. And as we're talking about the B-2, we should mention the March 9th, 1992 Aviation Week Space Technology article that specifically talks about how the B-2 electrically charges the leading edge of the wing to reduce the radar cross-section and then electrically charges the exhaust gases to reduce the infrared signature. But what was interesting is back in 1968, a report from Northrop indicated that when you do that, when you electrically charge the leading edge of the wing and then negatively charge the trailing edge, there is a aerodynamic drag coefficient reduction by up to 60%, thereby allowing the airline industry to save up to 60% in fuel consumption, which would be worth billions to the airline industry, but it's not being released.
Why do you think they don't release something like that?
Because it's unprofitable for them to do that. They could only charge you about $9 for a trip to New York City to Los Angeles. They can charge you $500 now. Why would they charge you $9 with that technology? So using this obsolete technology, it's still profitable for them to do that.
What's interesting is that maybe, and you would be able to tell me if this is true or not, it's the same companies that make those planes.
Yes.
That are the ones building this technology.
Right. There's two sides to this thing. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There is a privatized space defense contractor program, and then there's the public relations space program in the form of NASA, which is actually a military entity. So we've got two different tracks running here.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
It's incredible. Well, let's get back, getting back and relating this all to UFOs. There's a lot of information out there about what the Nazis might have had.
Mm-hmm.
There's photos out there of what looked to be like the UFOs that they saw in the 50s,
right,
that they say were Nazi built. What, as far as you know, was really worked on that is of this cutting-edge technology back then?
Well, the first thing I think is important to remember is what was procured under the closing years of the Third Reich, the Nazi SS, elements of the Luftwaffe who were borderline on that type of research. We should not underestimate what was made under the direction of SS General Hans Kammler at the Skoda Works in Czechoslovakia. The Russian Red Army, when they came into the Skoda Works, they actually got a gigantic truck full load of the Nazis' most secretly guarded anti-gravity propulsion technology, laminar flow control technology. We're talking about scalar wave weaponry. They got a jump on their space program. And so that cannot and should not be minimized or lessened in any type of way. And the full story of what happened to General Hans Kemmerer has never been told. He was the one who headed up the secret programs, research, development, test, and evaluation programs for the SS at that time. And he was intimately involved in the German program called Die Glocke, or the Bell, which carried the highest security classification that the Nazis had on any program they were running. So we don't want to underestimate what actually took place.
What was the Bell?
The Bell was approximately 15 feet high, about 8 feet in diameter. It had a bumper that went around the lower circumference of the vehicle. There were strange hieroglyphic writings around the circumference. Inside the Bell housing, near the upper portion of the craft, there were two counter-rotating drums that had a radioactive isotope, cerium-525, that was spun in two counter-rotating drums, and it did act as a torsional pinch-type device that could actually work as a bomb-type device or somewhat a anti-gravity-type vehicle. But what's interesting is, in 1965, almost the identical-looking craft crashed in Pennsylvania, almost near-image craft, Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, 1965, the same dimensions, the same bell-looking craft, and the same hieroglyphic writing around the circumference. So once again, it looks like this may have been a German craft.
With that craft, it was 15 feet high. Was it built to keep people in it?
It was not manned at all, no. In fact, many of the project engineers who worked on it suffered from the effects of radiation poisoning. And then when they put plants next to this vehicle, when it was powered up, in under a day, they completely turned to black rubber.
Oh, geez.
Yes, so this was very toxic to the environment and to humans. So, no, there were no test pilots in this vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not.
Well, and where does the information come that this vehicle existed? Is it pretty credible?
We have the testimony from the original engineers, actually 62 engineers. They left a paper trail. They were later murdered over this program.
Mm-hmm.
We also have eyewitnesses. Actually, some of the concentration camp survivors who actually worked on these vehicles did provide additional details. So we do have a historical paperwork to back it up.
Okay. These people who were killed that worked on it, were they killed by, or was this already members of the SS?
Members of the SS.
Okay, so this was during the war.
Yeah, during the war.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
This is just before the close of World War II. And it's believed, not proven, but it's believed that SS General Hans Kemmerer, who has had three different death stories, no one can nail down how this guy disappeared off the radar screen. I mean, he's the most historical. I challenge anyone to come up with someone who is more historically significant than SS General Hans Kemmerer. He was the key to all of this technology. Mm-hmm. He designed the concentration camps. This guy was a monster, but he was a technical genius, and he ran those programs for the SS. So the big question is, what happened to Kemmerer, and did he cut a deal with the Americans? It's never been proven either way. We still don't know what happened to him. And he was talked about in the trials when the Nazis were tried for their war crimes. He was specifically mentioned, and we don't know what happened to him. We just don't know.
Wow. Did he disappear after the war then? And
yes, we believe he disappeared, and we believe that he cut a deal with the Americans, and that is highlighted in this article. This is the London Daily Mail, August 12, 2001, talking about SS General Hans Kemmerer, the programs he was involved in, what he did, the dates, times, and places. So we have his historical account on record.
Well, it's interesting, too, that was written by Nick Cook,
yes,
who I've seen, he did that Hunt for Zero Point Energy.
It's a great book.
Yeah, a great documentary, too, that he did. You can still see that on YouTube.
Right, right.
And he found some interesting stuff.
He did.
Mm-hmm. The hieroglyphics on that bell object,
right,
like you said, they were similar to the Kecksburg. What the heck would something like that be used for? Why would they put
those? We don't know, and it's never been explained.
Okay.
It's never been explained what those hieroglyphic writings represented on the Nazi bell and what they represented on the Kecksburg acorn. It's never been talked about, and they could have been two different type writing. However, maybe it's not a writing in a language at all. Maybe, just maybe, that it is some type of a physical torsion pinch equation, and we've been thinking about it the wrong way all this time. We're all thinking that this is an alien writing from a different world or a different culture, but maybe it's a lot closer to home, and this is some type of a torsion pinch equation showing you how the vehicle starts up. That's just a guess, but that may be one scenario. It's not a language per se, but it's an actual mathematical equation.
So, for instance, torsion is sort of an energy, and I know the Russians talk about that a lot. And so these hieroglyphs may be interacting with this energy
Like a checklist on an aircraft. When you're flying a 747, the pilot in command who sits in the left seat, he has a checklist that he goes over, and on that checklist there is definite, definitive things that he must do and follow, and in some cases there's symbolic language associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
That may be the same thing happening on the Bell. It may have been a visual checklist on how to get this vehicle going and how to continue the operation.
Okay. Really interesting. Now, the information on the hieroglyphics and this Bell, when did that start to come out?
Immediately after the Kecksburg incident.
Okay.
Multiple eyewitnesses saw this acorn-shaped vehicle come down out of the sky, make a swooping turn. So number one, we know it's not a meteor because meteors don't make turns. Mm-hmm. They have straight line trajectories. It crash landed in the wooded area of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania in 1965. The firemen and civilian witnesses got there first. The military did not get there first, which is lucky for us, or we would have never even known about this. So when the witnesses got to the crash site, they saw this acorn-looking craft that was halfway embedded into the soil. They noticed that it had this raised section along the circumference, and there was this strange writing, which no one to this day within the civilian sector has been able to interpret properly or what that actually meant. And then what was interesting is military individuals, there were two men in black associated with this craft, and there were NASA people in white coats with the NASA insignia on it. They were also at this particular crash retrieval. This thing was loaded up on a military truck vehicle with a tarp half covering it. It was driven to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, and then it was, quote, entombed in a very specific area at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that had this insulating type block material, and they completely bricked the whole thing and never to be seen again.
Wow, and it's Wright-Patterson also is in charge of the Foreign Technology Division.
Yeah, they have Air Material Command there, and that is where a lot of this, I mean, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base has secrets to tell. Absolutely, they do. They do.
So other Nazi technologies, you said you have a patent to show that they were working on some sort of disc.
Sure. This story of the legend of the Nazi saucers is exactly that. It is known as the, quote, legend, because this has been handed down in ufology for decades now. So the question we should ask is there any physical proof to any of this, or is this just psychobabble? Is there any documented evidence that we can follow, a paper trail to indicate that, in point of fact, the Germans were working on circular disc-shaped aircraft? Well, fortunately, we do have some information here. We have a patent. This is from Mr. H. Fleschner, okay? Rotating jet aircraft with lifting disc, wing, and tanks. This is patent 2,939,648. So anyone can listen to this and get that patent. That's the actual patent number. And what they're doing here is, in many cases, they are sucking in the boundary layer using laminar flow control, which helps to increase the efficiency for vertical takeoff. And we've got the actual patent for it. And this is from an original German designer. Now, he was granted the patent, filed in March 28, 1955. It was granted June 7, 1960. So look at the historical lineage of what took place here. In 1955, they were working on atomic-powered aircraft, atomic-powered spacecraft, very exotic vertical takeoff vehicles. By 1960, Aviation Week Space Technology completely eliminated anything having to do with this type of technology. So it looks like The R&D began in 1955. By 1960, they made a massive breakthrough in this technology, and this is 9 years before Apollo 11, which may explain why Neil Armstrong won't talk about Apollo 11.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that perhaps he wasn't the first one there.
Okay.
Because are we really supposed to believe that we're using liquid rockets even after all this time? It's been well over 60 years. We're still using liquid rockets. Didn't they have anything better at that time? These patents, they go a long way to prove that something else was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So the modern UFO era kind of started in the 40s,
sure.
Really, after World War II, after they had their sightings in World War II of the Foo Fighters. And well, let's start right there with Foo Fighters.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any sort of technologies that were developed during or before World War II that might explain those?
Well, again, remember, too, though, that anything that we have today within the military-industrial complex, almost any military technology. We're talking about laser-guided bombs. We're talking about TV-guided air-to-air missiles. We're talking about phased array over-the-horizon radar, drones, UAVs. Were all, repeat, all developed by the Nazis before the close of World War II. So what we're doing here is nothing but a belated designer leak or a pale reflection of the German original. Mm-hmm. They were the origin point to all of this.
Okay.
So there is reports of these type spherical objects coming up from the bowels of Berlin, tracking and locking themselves in between the horizontal stabilizer of our B-29s, between the horizontal stabilizer and the trailing edge of the main wing, following these B-29s and B-17s throughout World War II, and then breaking away. Also reports of electromagnetic disturbances interact with the reciprocating piston engines on the B-17, causing them to crash. So it sounds like this is a lot of pre-done German hardware at that time. You know, are we to believe that aliens are causing, certainly there have been electromagnetic effects, but just think about the origin point of where these things were coming from when the B-17s were starting their bombing raid over the oil refineries and over the ball bearing plants, because by the end of 1944, we had completely bombed all the refineries and ball bearing plants out of existence, the runways as well. So they needed a VTOL option, which could be used as a rapid response.
So these orbs, the spheres that were seen, have you ran across any technology that would explain that? Or do you have any ideas around what those might have been if they were German weapons?
I believe that they were borderline psychological warfare operations, and that they did have the technology to short out the electrical systems on our B-17s and B-29s.
And do you have any idea of the technology behind those?
It goes into some of the electrogravitic effects, some of the, quote, Kugelblitz devices. Certainly what we see here in this patent is partially responsible for some of those sightings. And then you can also cross-reference that to June 24th, 1947. This is just before Roswell. Many eyewitnesses in New Mexico saw a crescent-shaped flying wing very similar to the Horton 229 model, which is of German origin. So again, all these leads are pointing back to the Third Reich.
Okay, and when you talk about a flying wing, you're talking of a delta shape, kind of like the stealth bomber.
Correct, because remember, too, that what Kenneth Arnold saw were 9, quote, flying saucers, but they weren't really flying saucers. The
right.
lead aircraft was a crescent flying wing configuration, and then the aircraft that were in back of the lead were a spade-shaped craft, similar to the Avro original Project Y. So again, this also has a lineage because the Avro Project Y looks identical to what Kenneth Arnold reported. So this is, again, pointing back to the Third Reich. It really is. It really is.
So then we get into later in the 40s and the 50s, and now you're having masses of sightings, a lot of sightings, mostly of round flying saucer-type objects.
Sure.
Do you attribute that possibly? Do you think?
Well, let's be clear. Absolutely. I mean, we have circular reports. We've got
right.
delta configuration. We've got chevron configuration. We've got mm-hmm. batwing manta ray type craft. We've got cigar craft. Just look at what happened between 1982 and 1989 in the Hudson Valley, New York area. Over 25,000 eyewitnesses reported seeing a gigantic flying wing delta type configuration that had a single trailing triangle edge to the craft. It was reported by multiple police officers, ATC. People pull off to the side of the road. They saw this craft. It was massive in size. It stopped traffic. It hovered. It was very slow flight. But what's interesting here, though, is reports from the eyewitnesses who looked up underneath this vehicle as it flew over. They said that it had translucent panels on the bottom. Mm-hmm. It had multiple lighting configurations on the belly of the craft. And they said that when they looked up through these translucent panels, they could see what they termed the cross-beam and I-beam construction, the grid work inside the vehicle itself. So, I asked the question, does an extraterrestrial vehicle need translucent panels? What in the world would you need translucent panels for? Mm-hmm. Well, if you're landing VTOL, like a helicopter, you would need to see your landing area. So again, it looks like this is a man-made technology using a Kevlar type exterior with a Teflon or perhaps a carbon fiber exoskeleton for the interior of the vehicle. But mm-hmm. I don't think that the Hudson Valley Boomerang was an extraterrestrial craft. I believe it was one of our LTA or lighter than air vehicles. That's from the 1976 report from McDonnell Douglas.
Okay. Well, before we get too much further where a lot of these people are going to start to get upset, let's do ask it the question.
Okay.
Since obviously you know a lot about these technologies, are there some technologies or things that you've seen that have been observed that are beyond what we would
have? Okay, so let's make something clear too, though. Is December 17th, 1903 mm-hmm. was the beginning of flight. That was Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina. However, we have reports of UFOs that date back to the ancient Romans, to the mm-hmm. ancient Egyptians. So to say that everything that we're seeing out here is man-made is not consistent with the historical record. So I want to make that clear. There is a core of reality to this phenomenon. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. These sightings go back for hundreds, thousands of years. We've got cases over Mexico City, early 1800s, talking about a spade-shaped shield-type object that had metallic wings that were shining down lights over the city. This is way before aircraft were ever built. So again, not everything we're seeing out there is man-made. There is a core of reality to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, with the people that you've talked to with all of these technologies, do they allude to the possibility that some of this is reverse engineered from captured craft?
We've heard those reports. We've mm-hmm. heard those reports. In fact, there's a vehicle out there called the Alien Reproduction Vehicle, also known as the Flux Liner. It's about 24 feet in diameter. It houses a crew of four. It uses off-the-shelf components within the aerospace industry, but the fact that it's called the Alien Reproduction Vehicle sort of leads one to believe that maybe this was a recovered craft that was reverse-engineered, and we tried to make another man version of it, a human-piloted alien craft version of it, via Operation Project Snowbird. Project Snowbird is the program to reproduced alien craft using American pilots for the crew members.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a real program. So it looks like, yes, there were actual crash retrievals. We know of at least one case that took place 2 years before Roswell where a UFO crashed in Alaska. It was in such a remote area that they never bothered to bring it back to the Air Force Base. They made a hangar surrounding the craft exactly where it landed. There were two beings involved that look exactly identical to humans. Hmm. One of them was still alive, and he taught American pilots how to fly this vehicle. So it's now part of the historical record.
Really? And yes. Where can you read about that?
This comes from one of the members of the Disclosure Project who tried to get this story out into the public media, but he was squelched and it never went anywhere. So I've been trying to track down more information on this, but the gentleman who told the Disclosure Project representative said that he was the military attaché who was in charge of the bill of materials for making the hangar. He was the one who bought the materials for the hangar, and they never bothered to bring it back. Wherever it landed, they built the hangar around the craft. It was circular in shape. It had the wingspan, the same diameter as the wingspan of a DC-6. That's
wow.
what the diameter of the craft was. And he said that there were two beings involved, and there was writing that you could see on the interior. He actually crawled in the craft himself. So that case has just never been talked about very much.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that case. That's incredible.
Legitimate case.
The Flex Liner, the alien reproduction vehicle.
Right.
Let's get into a little bit of that. First of all, how you know it exists.
Okay. Well, I personally know two people who have seen it up close.
Mm-hmm.
I've spoken to them by phone. Also, we have at least 10 other people who we know who have worked on the program. My good friend Mark McCandlish is the world's premier aerospace illustrator. He did the best illustrations of this vehicle based on the original eyewitness testimony that was seen at the November the 12th, 1988 Open House Air Show exhibit at Norton Air Force Base. And this portion of the exhibit, we believe, took place in the L-1011 hangar. That's Air Force Plant 42 Palmdale, the Lockheed facility. So that's where these craft were actually seen. But they were still part of a bigger exhibit at Norton. This was like the B section of it. And very quickly, those three craft that were at this display measured 24, 60, and 130 feet in diameter. They were all hovering off the floor. There were no wires, no supporting structure, no rigging on the bottom, no mounting plates, nothing. They were bobbing on their own type gravitic field, just like a tanker
wow.
bobs in the harbor. They just had this bobbing effect to it. The upper crew compartment housed six CCD cameras along the upper exterior of the craft and one on top for a total of seven. And these CCD cameras were, quote, taken directly off the Vegas casinos. Okay, so whenever you will go out in Vegas, you'll see everywhere inside the gambling area these little balls, these little black balls, looking down at you, making sure you don't cheat the house. Okay, and so that's what those cameras look like on the upper portion of the alien reproduction vehicle, also known as the Flux Liner. Those cameras could be slewed in conjunction to produce an artificial image on the inside of the pilot's visor via the Apache heads-up display. It's the same system they use on the Apache helicopter. Down that central column a little bit further is where the four F-4 Phantom ejection seat systems were. The same seat ejection system off the F-4 Phantom. Then there was perhaps a nuclear containment device that had about 11 and a quarter pounds of enriched uranium-238. There was an articulated arm associated with the bottom section of this vehicle. So that raises two questions. Number one, is that articulated arm used for launching of DOD classified payload? Or is that arm used for picking up samples from interplanetary star systems and planets? Who knows? But
yeah.
why would you need an articulated arm? I mean, are they taking samples from Mars or something? But obviously, they have a need for it. The exterior of the vehicle had these composite panels that came down a 30 degree from the vertical axis. And these panels were fastened by Zeus fasteners. So anyone who's familiar with a engine cowling knows that these Zeus fasteners, with about a half a turn on a screwdriver, they snap into place. That's how these composite panels were around the circumference of this vehicle.
Did any of these witnesses talk about when these things were developed?
Well, interesting you mention that. The one witness who came forward kind of in a strange way stated basically that this thing looked like it had been around for decades. There was fingerprint marks on it. There were grease stains on it. It was slightly beat up. It just looked old and clunky. I mean, it looked like it had been around for a long time.
Huh.
You know, so that's consistent with what we know about 1950 to 1960 when that research was expunged from the aerospace literature. So
you think those might have been developed in the 50s? Or
that thing could have been decades old.
Wow.
Yes.
And it seems to have the technology to be spacefaring.
Absolutely. In fact, it works better in outer space because they have the capability. They use the principles of high voltage electricity in conjunction with the B-field Brown effect. So they're using capacitor plates with always the positive plate on top, because that's how when you charge a capacitor plate, there's a direction in the movement of the positive charge. So that's why the positive plate is always on top. And you could vary the voltage on this capacitor section. That causes pitch, yaw, and roll. So, yes, it looked like these things had been around for decades.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. So if these were in the B section of this exhibit, what was in the A section?
The A section was the slightly less classified aircraft.
Okay.
So, for instance, the Pulsar or Flaming Pumpkin Seed was associated. That's 100 feet long, 65 feet wide. A flattened football diamond black-shaped craft that had heat-ablative thermal-resistant panels all around the vehicle. Tricycle landing gear, unmanned. Basically, when that craft got up to about Mach 3, they shut down the turbojet engines buried inside the fuselage of the vehicle. Then they slam shut the air intake ducts, which are the NACA air intake ducts, and at about Mach 3, the leading edge is glowing red hot. They start introducing a modified liquid methane fuel with a boron-based additive directly into the superheated shockwave. There's a compressibility factor. There's an explosion. It compresses between the superheated shockwave and the tapered afterbody of the vehicle, propelling it across the sky at about 12,000 miles an hour.
That's pretty incredible.
So that was at this exhibit.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of kind of triangular aircraft, one of the popular ones you hear about is TR-3B.
Sure.
What
sure.
is that, and does it exist?
TR-3B is also known as the Astra, and this comes in two different sizes. There is a, quote, alleged 300-foot per side triangle vehicle of it. There is also a 600-foot version of this craft. Both operate on the same principle as something called the magnetic field disruptor, which is a ring-shaped device in the central section of this craft. Basically, what they're doing is they're taking liquid mercury, they're pressurizing it to 250,000 atmospheres, they're rotating it at 50,000 RPM. There is a resultant decrease in the localized gravity field by up to 89%. That means that the multi-mode impulse rockets that are on each point of this triangle only have to propel 11% of the craft. And the G-forces are reduced by 89%. So you can, we hear these stories about these 90-degree right-angle turns at 40 Gs. Well, you're not experiencing 40 Gs. You're almost down to 4 Gs, which is completely survivable by pilots.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there's two different versions.
See, that's incredible. And, you know, of course, this is a lot of technology. It's kind of, you're thinking, wow, then what is ours and what isn't? But that's what's kind of hard these days to know. And that's where I've always felt, I've known, you know, when I was a kid, SR-71 Blackbird came out, and that was so advanced. But that was made decades
sure.
ago, before I was born. So if that's the latest technology I knew of, then it just goes to show that there are technologies out there I can't even fathom.
Ben Rich, before he died in 95, told Jim Goodall from his hospital bed that we have, quote, things flying that are 50 years beyond what you could possibly even dream of. So if you think about what happened in 1962, that was the first test flight of the A-12, which went on to become the SR-71. We as taxpayers, after 40 years, are supposed to believe that the A-12, the SR-71, is the, quote, fastest aircraft in the world at this time. That is the biggest joke in the world. That's absolutely the biggest joke mm-hmm. in the world. And there's a group of stealth pilots, SR-71 sled drivers, A-12, U-2 pilots called the Road Runners International, and they meet in Nevada every other year in October. And at the end of their meeting, they have a champagne toast where all these people hold up their glasses and they say, quote, and we're still the fastest, okay?
Wow.
So it's this big thing.
That's
they,
funny.
They think that they're still the fastest. Well, yeah, a lot of these guys have been retired for 30 years. They're not clued into what's going on now.
Well, I have a theory around that because, yeah, it's still classified even how fast the SR-71 really can go.
Right.
But it always goes up to just under escape velocity. So it always seemed to me perhaps they didn't want to admit that they have there are Air Force vehicles out there that can reach escape velocity where they can even go into space because they're not supposed to be going into space. NASA's supposed to be the only people doing that.
Well, you need 17,500 to get into orbit. You need 22,500 right in that area to get out of Earth orbit. So certainly, we know that the SR-71 can't go that fast, but they're not talking about the vehicles that we have that can get out there, that have no resemblance to the shuttle whatsoever. That is a complete family of vehicles that the taxpayer does not know about.
One of the things I looked into when I did a talks about UFOs in Colorado with Space Command, because it's located in Colorado, with out of Colorado Springs and Peterson Air Force Base. And I read the Space Command catalog, and it's really interesting because it talks about taking battles into space using space vehicles and space forces. It's almost like it's that thinly veiled what they might be doing.
Think about what NORAD is doing, okay? It's been reported that NORAD is tracking, quote, fast walkers on a weekly basis. Okay, these are UFOs. They're unacknowledged programs. They don't know what the origin point on a number of these craft are. And we have the testimony from the Disclosure Project representative program who talked about how we have DOD satellites, including Keyhole satellites from the National Security Agency. We've got CIA birds. We've got electromagnetic pulse weapons. We've got rail guns. We've got space-based weapon systems. But the problem is that these have nothing to do with incoming Russian ICBMs. These weapon systems are pointed away from the Earth as though they're anticipating something coming our way. Now, that's a question that needs to be answered.
Yeah, that is... Well, I do have another question here, actually, from someone in the chat. It'll be, I guess, our last question because we're about out of time. But they asked, with the Hudson Valley UFOs, if they were black projects, and how do you explain abduction cases that were linked to that case?
Very good question. Greer will talk to you about program life forms. These are alien entities that look like actual grays, but in point of fact are military synthesized program life forms that mimic and mock the same type categories that we know as grays. So
do you think those really exist?
I think they do. I would not put it beyond them.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you very much for being on the show. Really interesting. We'll definitely have you on again. Remember, everybody, we're going to be on again tomorrow, and we're going to have Richard Dolan, because we're going to be introducing the UFO field to the Phoenix area. Not that they haven't been exposed to it before with the famous Phoenix lights that happened over a decade ago now. But do you have a website or anything you want to tell people
All
about?
I really have is my Facebook page, so I've made everything available to the public on that. So
awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay, Michael Schratt. And, you know, I did scold our Facebook kind of admin person for not making an event for this radio show. I don't care if she was sick yesterday, because people got mad at me last week because she forgot to do that. She's not listening and making faces. Oh, now she's making faces. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me. Thank you very much for coming in today, Michael. And like I said, don't forget, come back to openmind.tv to listen to the show tomorrow. We'll have Richard Dolan. We'll have a new venue. We won't have our pretty screen behind us, but we'll be in an AM radio station, News Talk Radio, AM 1100 KFNX. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow, everybody. Let me find my closed music. There it is. Oh, I'm sorry. Technical issues.